The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, marijuana at the UN. The Nonviolent Radical Party, Transnational and Trans Party, with the support of the European Coalition for Just and Effective Drug Policies, organized a panel recently entitled Cannabis Legalization, Science and Policies, which was held as a side event at the 68th session of the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna, Austria. One of the panelists was Dr. Bo Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center, a senior policy researcher and professor of policy analysis at the RAND School of Public Policy.
The first point I want to make is, and this is something that I think is fairly obvious to most of the people in the audience, is that an increasing number of jurisdictions are allowing cannabis supply for non-medical purposes. You know, where I'm here based in the United States, and more than half the U.S. population now lives in states where cannabis legalization has passed. However, you have to keep in mind, it still remains illegal under federal law. And it was in late 2018 that the retail stores for adult use opened in Canada. But we all must remember that Uruguay was actually the first country to legalize in 2013. But this isn't just something that's happening in the Americas. So we know the Australian Capital Territory, Germany, Luxembourg, Malta, and South Africa have all legalized home production, as well as Malta and Germany have also allowed for the cannabis social clubs. And so I think we're going to hear from Heinrich here in a couple presentations to learn more about what's actually happening in Germany. There are also legalization experiments happening in Netherlands and Switzerland, and it's being seriously discussed in the Czech Republic and many other places. That said, in places that are implementing these approaches, they're not necessarily just implementing the for-profit approach that we see in the U.S. There are a lot of, if you're considering these alternatives to prohibiting cannabis supply, you have a lot of choices. And so, as I said, in the United States, this is typically how the conversation goes. Either people want to keep it prohibited, or you all want to allow for-profit companies to produce, transport, and sell. Now, it leads to questions. Is this profit maximization approach desirable? I mean, obviously, this is something that people are familiar with, in the U.S. and other places. But what you have to keep in mind, it's your really heavy users that drive the market for both alcohol and cannabis. And this is Pareto's law, the 80-20 rule. And we've found that it's about 20% of cannabis users, those that use on a daily or near daily basis, that account for about 80% of expenditures. So if you're a private company in the space, you realize that, that it creates a strong profit motive for these companies to maintain and promote heavy use. And then depending on the country, there can be very powerful lobbies that can fight against regulations and taxation. And in fact, that's something that we're seeing in multiple places throughout the U.S. But of course, there are other middle ground options. You know, for example, we could just allow adults to grow their own, as we see in an increasing number of places throughout the world. You could also just allow co-ops, as we've seen in Germany and Uruguay and parts of Spain. Or you could just have the retail sales model that you kind of see in the Netherlands. However, it's interesting. Sometimes when you present these options to different policymakers, they'll look at them and say, that's fine, but where's the revenue coming from? Because in some places, they actually care about the tax revenues. Now, in other countries, that's not part of the conversation. But if you are in a place where tax revenues from cannabis is kind of at the top of the, or is part of the policy conversation, you still have other middle ground options short of allowing for-profit companies to sell. Obviously, you could have state stores. This is something that we see in parts of Canada, where the government runs the stores. And in fact, in Canada, in almost all the provinces and territories, the government serves as the wholesaler. You could also potentially limit participation to nonprofit organizations. And even if you're going to allow for-profit companies to get involved, you could require that they be for-benefit or B Corps, right? You know, that companies that focus not just on profits, but also on people and planet. You know, there's a lot of different options available to jurisdictions. And as I said, once you get outside of the United States, you see much more interest in these middle ground approaches. Now, the final point I want to make is that in places that, especially those that have adopted these commercial for-profit regimes, we see that cannabis prices are going down. And this matters for a lot of the outcomes that get discussed in legalization debates. If you look at what's going to happen to the size of the illegal market, what's going to happen to consumption, what's going to happen to tax revenues, what about the profitability of these businesses, which is actually really important when we start talking about social equity. All of these outcomes are going to be determined by the price of cannabis in the legal regime and how it compares to the price in the illegal market. Now, we know there are multiple reasons why legalization will push down production and distribution costs. And a lot of this work relies on stuff that Peter Reuter observed 40 years ago. Most importantly is this idea of risks and prices. So if you're in a place, you know, you're purchasing cannabis on the illegal market or methamphetamine or cocaine, realize a lot of what you're doing is compensating the drug dealer and everyone else along the supply chain for the risk of arrest and risk of incarceration. And realize, you know, with legalization, that will go away. There's also what Peter calls the structural consequences of product illegality, which is just a fancy way of saying that when you're operating in the illegal market, it's just less efficient. You know, you have less access to capital. And if you were to bring a lot of this above board, it would, you know, make things much more efficient. And then finally, if you're going to allow large companies to get involved and grow, you know, this can, you know, there can be increasing returns of scale. This could really push down those production and distribution costs. However, this doesn't mean that retail prices have to fall as well. This is a policy choice. However, the way this is rolled out in the United States, not only have the, you know, the production and the wholesale prices gone down, so have the retail prices. So just for one example, this is the U.S. state of Oregon, which legalized around 2016. You can see that this is the price per the median price per gram of flower. And was, you know, in 2017, it was above $10. Today, it's now less than $4, more than a 60% drop. But one thing you want to keep in mind is this is just looking at the price per a gram. But we also realize there have been changes in potency over this time as well. And so when you're talking about prices, you actually want to spend time talking about the price per a unit of THC. And in fact, that's something Peter's going to talk about because we've been doing some research on that in California. Obviously, you know, if the production and the distribution costs go down, as I said, you've got choices if you want to keep the price, if you want to inflate those retail prices. Obviously, with government storage, you can control the product, control the price. Even if you don't have a government storage, you can still set the price or you can set a minimum price. There's a lot of conversations about that with respect to alcohol. You know, you can require rigorous testing or other, you know, there could be other regulations where they could, you know, be expensive and then, you know, maybe those costs get passed on to the consumer. And then obviously you can levy taxes. Let me be very clear. Nobody knows the best way to tax cannabis. There are lots of different ways to do it. But I think there's a growing consensus that ad valorem taxes, where you tax cannabis as a function of its price. For example, in California, it's an extra 15% excise tax. In Washington state, it's extra 37%. What we're realizing is that these excise taxes probably aren't the best way to tax cannabis, because if your taxes are set as a function of the price and your prices go down, well, so will your tax revenue unless you see a big increase in consumption. And so I do think you're going to hear a lot about alternative approaches, especially taxing cannabis as a function of potency. You know, it's Delta 9 THC concentration. There are a couple advantages to that. It's not as susceptible to the price drops, but also if you're going to legalize, like in the United States, we really, you know, except for edibles, you know, we really don't have potency limits or really kind of much control over the products. Really, you know, we're allowing a lot of the private companies to decide this. You know, if you're not going to ban products or cap potency, another way to potentially nudge people towards some of the lower potency products is by taxing as a function of the THC concentration. So to conclude, look, if you're thinking about these alternatives prohibiting cannabis supply, it's not a simple yes or no. You're going to confront a lot of different choices. And definitely, as you kind of think through, you know, these various outcomes, you need to be thoughtful about prices. I remember when with Peter and others, you know, 15 years ago, when we raised this issue about the prices going down, I remember a number of people saying, what do those RAND nerds know about growing cannabis? You know, no one was really talking about this, but you know, we had talked to cannabis farmers, and we talked to people who were growing other crops, and we knew this was going to happen. And in fact, this is exactly how it's played out. So you have to be thoughtful about it. Because I want to make it clear, even though your production and distribution costs can go down, it doesn't mean the retail prices have to go down as well. And as I said, I think you're going to hear a lot more about potency taxes based on Delta 9 THC concentration. They're doing this in Canada, a couple U.S. states. And I suspect there's going to be more research on this as well. The final point I want to make is, as I think it was when I was introduced, I'm the vice president of the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy. And just want to let you know, we're going to be having our meeting in Manchester in the UK, June 11th through 13th. I really hope many of you can be there. If you're interested in conversations like cannabis legalization, this definitely is the conference for you. There will also be a methods workshop the day before, focusing both on quantitative and qualitative methods in the state of the art in those fields. And if you're interested, just feel free to register at ISSDP.org. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Beau Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center, speaking on a panel entitled Cannabis Legalization, Science and Policies, which was held as a side event at the 68th session of the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna, Austria. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more from that panel on cannabis legalization, which was organized by the Nonviolent Radical Party, Transnational and Trans Party, with the support of the European Coalition for Just and Effective Drug Policies. Another speaker in this panel was Dr. Peter Reuter, a longtime drug policy researcher and a professor in the School of Public Policy and the Department of Criminology at the University of Maryland.
I'm presenting here some results primarily by my two colleagues, Greg Majette and Cody Carr, as part of a longer-term project to analyze the consequences and assess the overall effect of legalization of cannabis in California. So it's not as though the legalization of recreational cannabis in California came out of the blue, so to speak. There was a vibrant, i.e. very lax, medical cannabis regime that had developed before 2016 when the recreational market became legal. And the estimate, there's just a one-point estimate of about 5% of adult Californians accessing cannabis through the medical distribution system. And that's not inconsistent with studies that have been done on a more systematic basis and more regular basis for the state of Colorado. So this 5% is a credible estimate. The legalization was passed in November 2016, took effect January 1st, 2018. It was only for adults 21 and over, and it came along with some reforms in the criminal justice system, in particular, reducing punishment for cannabis-related offenses and erasing the record for many people who had cannabis-related sentences previously. So we pick up the story in 2020. So the system has been operating for 2 years, and we're sort of through the earliest just learning experiences. Don't think there's a lot to be learned about what the market will look like by looking at those first 2 years. And if you look at these data through the first half of 2024, it looks like in terms of revenue, it's pretty stable around between $4 and $5 billion. You get a sense that maybe something more is going on when you look at units sold and you realize that over that period, and this is effort to standardize the quantities that you get through a variety of products, but the total number of units sold rose by about 50%. But even that is only a sort of hint as to what's going on. The total consumption of THC, the active ingredient, rose fourfold over the period from 2020 to the first half of 2024. And that represents the consequence of dramatic declines in the price per milligram of THC in all forms. So for flower, the estimate was that it was 6 cents per milligram THC in 2020, and that had declined by two-thirds to just 2 cents in 2024. And you see, I won't go through all of them, but pre-rolled, infused, those are flower that's been rolled into effectively cigarettes and have been made stronger by the addition of some infused liquid. And there you see a decline of 60% over that same time period. So there's no mystery here. The increase in THC, at least there's no mystery to the increase in THC content. It just represented the consequences of the substantial decline in the prices. I should say there is a slight question around the quality of the data on potency. Labs competed for the business of establishing potency, and some of them cheated so that they would show higher potency measures, which are attractive to retailers. There were some prosecutions, and the problem may not have been that serious. But now let's look at what people are choosing to consume. And the story here is that we have, you know, six different products. Flower and vapes are the most important ones. And the shift was from flower, 52% in the 2020, down to 38% 2024, to vapes from 21% to 30%. And the vapes are indeed substantially more more potent. And you can see here the retail sales share by product type. And again, it sells the same story. It's vapes and flower, but increasingly the share is going to vapes. And now, instead of looking at quantity at sales, we look at the share of THC that is consumed in each form. And now we're looking at the potency of different products. So flower has become substantially more potent, from 22% to 29%, and vapes, which were at a staggering 84%, moved to an even more staggering 90%. There is an increase in all forms, in the potency associated with all forms, which brings us to the next slide, in which you see the share of THC by product type. And what you see is that flower accounts for about half of it, and vapes account for about 28%. Everything else is sort of fairly minor. Pre-roll infused increased substantially. It's now about 12% of the total. These are preliminary data, not yet published, but should be out in the literature in the near future. Are these increases in potency only in the legal market? And the answer is yes. These are not very good data, because it's just very few samples of potency in illegal cannabis. As you can see, there is a spike in, I think, 2019. But basically, the illegal market is still selling cannabis flower that is much less potent than what's available in the legal market. So let me wrap up with some... there was one other thing. So what share of all cannabis is consumed in the legal market? And the answer is, go back one, please. That about half of cannabis consumption comes from its legal recreational market, but there's a broad confidence interval around that. And that doesn't mean that all the rest of it comes from illegal. It could just be survey underreporting. We know surveys underreport consumption of psychoactive substances in general. There's homegrown cannabis. It could be that some people who are getting it from the illegal market are really getting it as a secondary from the legal market. So this is not an estimate of what share is coming from the illegal market. So how does one assess how well this has all worked? And the answer is, well, it depends what your evaluation criteria are. What were your objectives? A lot of the effort to legalize recreational cannabis in the US was driven by the discrepancy in arrest rates by race. The black arrest rates were much higher than white, even though the prevalence of cannabis use was pretty similar in two populations. But that's, of course, just one of many criteria that you could use. The reduction in arrests associated with this legalization, particularly in sales arrests, I think is unquestionable gain, but you didn't have to legalize to get that. You just had to change police behavior. There are an increasing number of users who are using cannabis every day, and the increase in THC in the potency of cannabis suggests that they may be increasingly suffering from cannabis use disorder, probably a negative. And nothing else is well enough measured for us to have any views about it. Is cannabis be using as a pain management instead of more dangerous opioids? No idea. Cannabis involvement in traffic accidents, as Carla's work suggests, we know very little about that. And we are still, even 5 years later, looking at relatively early adaptation. I mean, how are parents going to deal with their children's cannabis use over the long term? And it will take a long time before we have an understanding of that. So there's no final judgment that can be rendered. I think it's important to monitor these developments, but it's far too early to make a final judgment on this. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Peter Reuter, a longtime drug policy researcher and a professor in the School of Public Policy and the Department of Criminology at the University of Maryland, speaking on a panel entitled Cannabis Legalization, Science and Policies, which was held as a side event at the 68th session of the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna, Austria. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Another of the speakers was Heinrich Wieker, a former electrical engineer and the founder of the Hanover, Germany Cannabis Social Club.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for the invitation. My name is Heinrich Wieker. I'm from Germany by profession. I'm an engineer and I do hemp harvesting technologies since 2016. And that was also the year when I founded the Cannabis Social Club of Hanover. And that was not a regular social club as we imagine today, but it was an activist group to do some political work and connect with other so-called cannabis social clubs. There were five in numbers from 2015 to 17 or something. And of course, the things changed a lot in 2021 when the traffic light government announced that they would want to regulate cannabis finally. Enrico, can I see my presentation, please? It is all black screen.
Okay.
Will help me a little. But what I wanted to do is give a short survey about the situation in Germany 1 year after the cannabis regulation. What happened, and part of it is, of course, the approach that when cannabis was under the Merkel administration, quite unpopular, but we had the fact that it was scheduled as a medical drug finally. So they wanted to prevent home grow for patients and quickly made the medical law. That was in 2017. And that was a major impact also in the public mindset about cannabis. So it was more accepted and it was possible finally to talk about it. In the end, they had a hard time to figure it out how to put that cannabis law at work. And for us, it was a lot of waiting for the draft of the cannabis law. Then we had a hard time to find out if the Federal Council will pass the law, the Abstimmung, the survey in Bundestag about the law itself, and then what it would show and how it would work in the public. So first results, of course, for us as the consumers was that the self-confidence on carrying cannabis in public was absolutely increased, especially when it comes to meeting the police or authorities. And that helped a lot. Also, police cops were telling that it made a major difference in prosecuting real crime in, for example, red light districts instead of prosecuting every single gram of cannabis instead. That took away the efforts. And yeah, about the election, we were quite insecure about it. It would turn out, it was quite sure that the Christian Union would be for the next government or bring the next chancellor. Question was only the coalition partners. The choices are not too many, and most probably now, or it turns out as safe, that the SPD, the Social Democrats, will join with the Christian Union. And of course, the Minister of Health, Karl Lauterbach, he proposed to legalize or at least regulate cannabis as an adult use drug. And if he's maintaining the Ministry of Health, there is, of course, no chance that they will return the cannabis law or withdraw it. Other voices were popular mainly through the election battles, but we think this was populistic. Means just a trial to bring some emotions into the conservative arguments. But they have muted so far, and the cannabis is not yet on the agenda for the coalition discussions that they just do right now. So this is a situation after the election. The right swing was not as hard as we were concerned of. The AfD, which is the nationalistic party in Germany, is quite under control, more or less. But everybody refuses. Excuse me, correct me if I'm wrong. There will be time afterwards. Of course, they are not really under control, but they are excluded from governmental business, and they don't have a word in drug policy at this moment. Another topic I was asked to refer about is the business. Not much has changed. The Minister of Agriculture has promised to us that the intoxication clause for industrial cannabis will fall. It didn't work out. Same with the novel food regulations of CBD that blocks cannabis a lot. Hasn't changed, and we are waiting, of course, for improvements in the use of industrial cannabis for fibers, textiles, and in the building market, which would be super important. But this is not a major effect. But what we have seen is that the cannabis imports, namely the medical imports, have increased by more than double. And this is all cannabis that went directly, most probably, in the recreational market. So there is a sort of gray zone how to see it correctly. There were enormous ease to have access to medical cannabis, to telemedicine, and many people used it. So the percentage of people who were actually patients and were just supplied from the black market or denied from the cannabis supply by the insurances is quite unclear, but we see that there is a big demand, and probably the telemedicine just fulfills the task of the legal shops and have access to the cannabis.
That was Heinrich Wieker, founder of the Hanover, Germany Cannabis Social Club, speaking on a panel entitled Cannabis Legalization, Science and Policies, which was held March 14th as a side event at the 68th session of the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna, Austria. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.